Restaurants employ over 15 million people nationwide, and two-thirds of all restaurants are independently owned and not part of big chains. Yet currently, these small businesses are not represented in government relief negotiations. Roar is working to change that by fighting for relief opportunities for all restaurants. Roar is advocating for an 8-point plan in New York State that will allow restaurants to reopen and rehire when the time comes. Dozens of industry leaders have signed on to the plan, like Nam Wa Tea Parlor, Field Trip, Momofuku, and many more of your favorites. You can join them at change.org by searching for ROAR, Relief Opportunities for All Restaurants.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. So today's show is a little different. It's a very special episode I recorded at Philly Chef Conference earlier this month with the brilliant chef Eric Williams of Virtue in Chicago. If we sound happier about the state of things, it's because we were. This was recorded on Sunday, March 1st, before restaurants and businesses nationwide were shut down because of COVID-19. I hope you'll listen to this episode and support independent restaurants like Virtue, who need your help now more than ever. Virtue, if you're in Chicago, has started a curbside pickup of family meals and dishes, so you can support them that way. Other restaurants are selling gift certificates or doing delivery. I highly, highly encourage you to support your local independent restaurants at this time. And I hope all of you are safe and healthy. And I'll catch you next time on A Hungry Society. Thank you all for coming. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. I feel like this is like a very intimate setting for this, and I'm excited to see all of you out here. So I'm gonna do a quick intro for you, chef. Eric Williams is owner and executive chef at Virtue Restaurant and Bar in Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood, which opened in 2018. Williams is a Chicago native with a storied career, having embedded himself into the culinary scene, beginning with his time as executive chef at MK the Restaurant in Chicago's River North neighborhood. And last week, Williams was named a semi-finalist for the James Beard Foundation's Best Chef Midwest Award, which is a big deal.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm so excited to chat with you. One of the things I love about kind of Virtue's story is the section of your website that's called Gratitude, which I don't know if I've ever seen a restaurant explicitly say we have gratitude for so many things. But can you talk about the Frederick Douglass quote that's on your site?
Sure. I think it's important to talk about why it's gratitude before you get to Frederick Douglass. So the restaurant being named Virtue, gratitude happens to be a virtue. And so we wanted to really showcase this idea of what virtues are and what they meant to us and how they relate to how we respond to people on a day-to-day basis. And so generally chefs talk about their love for food, their passion as creatives, and the evolution of that practice. And part of what allows chefs to be great are the platforms in which they stand on, and those platforms happen to be restaurants. And so there are many interactions that take place before a diner ever puts anything in their mouth or ingests anything in the space. And so we wanted to show a rich appreciation for this idea that our carpenters, our investors, journalists, everyone that played a what we thought was a pivotal role in us being able to just open and realize a dream, we wanted to show gratitude to them and pay homage to the idea that their labor was as important as ours was. So Frederick Douglass is a person that I've studied since childhood. And one of his many speeches has a excerpt that we share, which is, "Where there is no struggle, there is no progress." And when I think about that in my own life and I look through the lens of growth and development, my hardships have produced something. And I've spent a good amount of time thinking about, you know, the difference between the time it takes to make coal and the time it takes to make a diamond. And for most of us that appreciate fine jewelry, there's something unique about diamonds in their raw state and in their polished state. But they're also used as a tool because they're so hard. And so they're used at the end of really industrious and commercial drills to break through softer substances. And so if I thought about my career as this process, very similar, or in terms that chefs would often use, if I thought about my career as being forged over a period of time, and forged comes up a lot because all of us use knives, then what's the end result of this forged material, right? It's a very sharp blade that in some cases could be brittle, depending on how sharp it is and what the metal is. It has this rich characteristic because it goes from being hammered to being cooled and shaped. And during that process, you end up with something that A, is unique, but something that's malleable to get to a space where people can appreciate it and utilize it over a period of time. And so we see restaurants as vehicles that are shaped and that are malleable, and the people who go through them, right, take on different shapes and different forms. And we want to pay respect to the end result. We want to pay respect to how things begin and also how they take shape over a period of time.
It's so interesting you say that, because I always tell people that restaurants are, you know, like a bottle of wine. It's like a living, breathing organism, and it's different every day depending on who walks through the doors, like yeah. You said, but who's working, and you know how the cooks are feeling that day. And I think restaurants are really just, they're little societies in and of themselves.
I would agree.
So I really want to know, like, how you describe your food. You use the term Southern on your website.
Yes.
And I've heard people refer to Chicago as, you know, the North, like Southern mm-hmm. culture in the North. Uh-huh. So do you consider your food to be strictly Southern, or are there other influences as well?
Well, they're definitely, well, here, let me say this correctly. We're contemporary Southern. Southern is a term that is very loose. It's not really defined in our country. And that's why we decided to tackle it. Because as a chef and as a person who prides itself on wanting to know more and wanting to be more engaged as it relates to history, I'm very confused. I don't understand why we say barbecue and not Southern food. I don't understand why we say Creole Cajun and we don't say Southern, mm-hmm. right? If Louisiana's not in the South, I don't know where it is. I don't understand why Florida feels like it's on an island when it's connected to land. Right. And so when you start to talk about the South, we disconnect all these spaces. It's like we're talking about this land that's not connected to anything, and it's all connected. Mm-hmm. And from the African-American experience, it's very unique. Because African Americans have fought really, really hard as a result of our ingenuity, as a result of our labor, and as a result of our intellectual property being stripped from us. We fought really hard to hold on to one piece that we all relate to, and it's called soul food. And soul food, as I understand it, is the best of scrap cookery, right? The best of country cooking. And so now you add this layer. Well, chef, if that's your title, then how do you discuss this? Well, I have to discuss it through the lens that when I grew up understanding how to cook, the fundamentals of cooking were French cooking. The problem is that's not exactly accurate. It's the fundamentals of cooking for anyone who wants to cook French food, But some of the techniques and methods don't always translate into Japanese cuisine. They don't always translate into other constructs. And so the French did a really, really good job of organizing kitchens and organizing a chain of command and organizing structures that we have, many of us have adopted in kitchens and in business. But that doesn't do anything for me in some Middle Eastern fare. There are things that have parallels and there are things that are really, really different. For example, I can't think of one dish where the French, or one dish in Southern cuisine, where we go out and find something that's poisonous and then process it and then give you a dab of poison right before we serve you the part of the particular item that is delicious. That's a Japanese technique. And part of the pride is for them to take this poisonous fish and give you just a little bit of the poison so that you know that it's poison. And then let you know, after you freaked out, that you're not gonna die. You can enjoy your meal now, right? And that's pretty cool for the ones that are adventurous, yeah, right? But some of these things just don't translate. Mm-hmm. So with that being said, so America, without getting political, is a melting pot of all cultures, all nationalities, all races, all immigrants. And the part that we conveniently leave out is all of those folk at some point shared their wares. They brought them with them, right? The ingredient bases, their techniques, and they have settled throughout our country. The keepers of those techniques, the keepers of those ingredients happen to look like me. They were African Americans. Because whether we want to admit it or not, slaves were the labor force. And that's undeniable. Yeah. And so if they were the labor force, then how in the hell does French cuisine become the foundation for cooking? If Italians had the farm, or if Irish had the farm, or whoever it was, whether it was of European descent or somewhere else. I mean, we forget really quickly that like there was this thing called the Louisiana Purchase, which meant Spain owned Louisiana. And if you think about in context what jollof rice is, what paella is, then jambalaya probably feels somewhere right in the middle of those two things. And so it's inspired by those ingredient bases and those techniques. And so when I think about Southern cuisine, then I think about this melting pot of techniques from lands and from regions that are in some ways untapped and in some ways unrefined, because we have data, we have proof of what soul food is as it relates to the African American culture. And we have that because there was scrap cooking that came from out of the fields that traveled north, right, as people traveled to freedom or traveled to work. But what's the documentation, or where's the documentation of what happened on the other side, yeah, right, in the home?
Absolutely.
The keepers of, right, this labor force. And so so that's really where my intrigue lies, and that's really where some of the inspiration comes from. We obviously do things that are very easy for people to grasp, right? We make macaroni and cheese. We make it great. But we make it. We make collard greens. We have ingredients that people could readily identify. But we also have ingredients that would have somebody wondering a little bit, you know, does this boy really know how to cook Southern food? Because I'm also inspired by the folk that ended up in the South. And so I can't cook with just okra, knowing that okra came from Africa, or just rice, knowing that the strand that we use as Carolina gold rice was only used because A, it was swampland, and B, Africans knew how to plant it, right? And right, it made it really easy to sell because they had a labor force that could produce it. So then I start thinking about things like coconut, and coconut doesn't show up a ton unless it's coconut cake in the South, mm-hmm, but it's rich, it's a fat, and chefs tend to like to cook with fat because fat holds flavor. It's a healthier fat, and it's a robust flavor. And so those things those ingredients pay homage to a place that impacted our country by way of flavor, but might not necessarily show up in what you would consider traditional Southern food.
Yeah. You said a lot of very interesting and important things. One of the things you talked about just now is documentation. Mm-hmm. And I have this conversation with other writers and chefs as well of, you know, it's not that French food is inherently better. It's just that they were able to document all of these different, you know, like they were able to document like how you organize a kitchen, how you build mother sauces, all of that. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, it's not that soul food isn't interesting or diverse or takes skill. It's just that, you know, African Americans didn't have an opportunity to document those skills that they were learning. And I think that that's how we start to correct the narrative is we start to, you know, at least with my role as a writer, I try to document the work that's happening right now and have these conversations so that in the future people can look to a chef like you and be like, oh, actually, like, okay, he was making rice with coconut in it. He was connecting these through lines from Africa to here and beyond. So they can pick that up and continue to work with it. I think one of the ways you are able to say, oh, well, this wasn't like a very, I don't want to use the word intelligent, but like, I think the ways in which we talk about Southern food, the ways we talk about, you know, cooks on plantations, it's not with this reverence. And we absolutely need to have reverence that we're taking those scraps and making these dishes that traveled the entire country that have become soul food, that have become staples. And that's brilliance. That's genius in my mind, for sure.
It's also American ingenuity.
Yeah.
So if we were talking about a guy who used to make horseshoes, who's now fabricating knives, we would say that guy's brilliant. He's recreated himself, mm-hmm. right? If we talked about someone who braided hair for a living and is now weaving, you know, the highest brand of women's handbags, we would be like, oh my God, right? But chefs don't get that kind of credit. We're expected to produce at the highest level on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And when there's a discovery, it's kind of just like, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, like athletes, the best athletes make it to the Hall of Fame. The highest percentiles are like 50%. If you can score 50%, right? If you're a basketball player, 50% of your shots go in, it's a shoe-in. Baseball, 300 percentile, which is 30%, right? On base, shoe-in. Chefs, 90 percentile.
Yeah, 50% won't work.
Right. And there's no Hall of Fame for chefs, by the way. Right. We get recognized amongst our peers. We don't know how we're getting recognized. Right. We get awards, but we have no idea, right? There's no clear scale to grade a chef on his performance. But every customer that walks in there that has the opportunity to find a handy app and critique us are ready, right, to mm-hmm. give us a pass or fail based on that night's performance. Mm-hmm. And if you get enough fails lined up in a good night, it could be your last performance. Mm. It's like such an unreal expectation. And so we're adrenaline junkies. I don't think chefs back down from the challenge or the unscalable task of being creatives, standardizing recipes, teaching people who believe they can do something that they haven't done the proper research to understand whether or not they can do it, mm-hmm. right? Being cooks and sometimes our service staff. We enjoy those kind of things, and that's why we do what we do. And that's what leads me in this path, and that's what inspires me to open up a crazy place where I just want to treat people really well and talk about virtues and people who, you know, have been dead at least 50, 60 years and quote them. And then cook food that's been cooked, you know, 1,000 times over, and mm-hmm. try to figure out how to reinvent it every day I go to the restaurant without anybody being offended at the idea that I'm changing something that in their mind should be traditional.
Mm. Are people offended? Have you had a few folks say that they're offended by what you're trying to do?
Well, I, I bet if you called any of your grandparents and told them that you interviewed a black guy who's changing what you would consider soul food, they'd have some choice words for you to tell me.
I just thought of my grandmother, who's Caribbean, Jamaican peas and rice. She is always like, no, it's rice and peas. We're from St. Thomas. We don't say it that way. And I'm like, we're all eating the same stuff.
Yeah,
like,
we can't even figure out how to enunciate it, right?
Right.
You're talking about changing it? Yeah.
Right. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And it's like, it's the same thing. It's just the, the words we arrange. But yes, people hold on to traditions with their whole heart and fist. But I think it's really, it's amazing what you've been able to do. And I'm curious, like, why do you think virtue has resonated so deeply, like not just with Chicago, but with like writers all over the country and diners all over the country?
I think it resonates for a couple of reasons. I think people are craving kindness from every walk of life. And we work really hard to make sure when you sit in that restaurant that you are treated like a guest and not like a customer. That serves us very well because it gives people space where they matter first, and it creates a platform for us to extend that and also receive it. So it's an exchange that's taking place. And that happens before, when we do it right, that happens before the food ever gets down. And so if you think about mindset and food, and this is not a, you know, anything that's scientific, it's pretty common sense for most of us, you're hard pressed to meet anybody that's never been hangry. And if you've had an experience called hangry, it doesn't matter how good the food is if it comes too late. You're still ticked off. You are completely full, but you're still ticked off. And you are angry at the person that delivered the food. You don't care what they had to do to get it. You don't care if they traveled across the world, killed a chicken, brought it back fresh, and roasted it over a spit after they cut down a tree. You should have got it here faster, right? Because you're emotionally off. You just are, right? And so we just decided to say that, look, we've been hangry before. We know what it feels like to be so hungry that you're just like the awful side of you is coming out. So why don't we just start people in the right space? Why don't we start them with kindness? Why don't we let every person that comes in here who's really hangry debate with themselves about whether they should keep treating us the way they want to treat us? Because I didn't do anything to you, right? I didn't stop your meal plan. I didn't tell you to go on a crash diet and lose 20 pounds in a week, right? I wasn't the guy who cut you off right before you walked in the restaurant, or whoever that was. I didn't fire you today, right? It's all these things that happen while we're hungry, right, that continue to trigger us. And honestly, all we're saying when we're hangry is, I need a win. And food is satiating and is satisfying, right? And so what we try to do is set the stage for you to be satisfied and satiated. And we just try to do it in the kindest manner. And then if we get you to that space, then we can kind of, you know, reveal some delicious.
Are you saying Chicago is a hangry city? Is that?
I'm saying I meet people every day, and I happen to be one of them some days. And I just try to identify my own needs, and I recognize quickly when those needs aren't being met. And since I have the opportunity to impact change, that's what I do. And so this restaurant is part of that exercise. I crave kindness. I meet people every day that crave kindness. I know if I decide I'm going to do intermittent fasting, which I do. I'm not doing it currently. But when I do it, somewhere around 2:30, 3 o'clock, it's going to be hell to pay if I can't get a meal. You know? And that's a very real space for me. And I do know that I'm inspired by the idea that many of the people that I've met who have been around older people, like, they don't take that mess. Right, like you go around somebody's grandmother, grandmothers don't move fast. They just don't. They inherently don't. Right? Could you imagine going to somebody's grandmother's house like acting a complete ass because you're hungry? Yeah. Like that's just not a thing. Right? It's rude. It's disruptive. Like you would never be invited again, and you might not be talking to whoever invited you again after that. Right?
Yeah.
There's a certain amount of calm that's evoked in older people's homes that I would translate into the highest level of hospitality.
That's a great model for how to provide hospitality for people. It should feel like you're coming into someone's grandmother's home and act with some like respect when you come in here.
The Japanese do it very well. They give you tea first. It's very, very hard to drink tea fast. It is.
Yeah, no, right? It's true. Yeah.
And so what does it do? It slows you. It's a process, right? You get warm towels in some restaurants before you eat. It slows you. And it feels almost ceremonial. And so we just want to slow the world down a little bit, right? If just for a few minutes, because we recognize the importance of the dinner table. And I know that people would expect someone who cooks for a living to talk more about food and less about service and hospitality. But again, I think that as any performer would really want to make sure that the stage is sturdy, right? If they're going to put on a true performance, I have to make sure that my stage is intact. And my stage happens to be a restaurant. And my team happens to set that stage. And so if the stage is set right, I've got a lot of room to be creative. No one goes to creative restaurants that don't trust chefs. You just don't. You go somewhere where you know what the food's going to be before you got there. Nobody's sitting through 28 courses of a 28-course meal and paying what those meals cost if you're not adventurous. And so I have to get people into a space, right, because we're not doing 28 courses. They expect the meal to be a certain thing, even though we're going to tweak it a little bit. And so we got to get you in the mindset to receive that. And we think the easiest way to do that is to build trust right into our platform and right into the format.
Oh, that's really beautiful. And to me, like food, service, hospitality, it's all, you can't really disconnect one from the other because the whole thing will fall apart, especially in a restaurant like yours or in many restaurants. They're inextricable. Like you can't pull them apart. They all have to be like baked in together.
Agreed.
Yeah. So I have some set questions I ask every guest on my podcast.
Okay.
That we'll run through. But can you point to a restaurant experience that shaped you either as a chef or a person?
I can't. Because restaurant experiences haven't taken the lead on shaping me as a chef. As ironic as that would seem. I grew up in the inner city of Chicago. I didn't have access to travel like many chefs have had over the years. I didn't start traveling until well into my career. And so the things that impacted me most were books. And they allowed me to take that travel that I wasn't able to physically take through a vehicle. And a lot of what shaped me, hence the fact that we name a restaurant Virtue, was the value base that my family laid out and I often go back to. And I find a lot of importance there and I find a lot of structure there. And even so much to say that like there are a lot of touches in our restaurant that resonate to home, because the person that exuded the most hospitality to me was my great grandmother. And that's why it's so easy for me to talk about, right, how older people slow you down without even trying to. They're just moving slow, right? And if you want to be around them, you better slow down too. And I don't know how it is in anyone else's world, but I came from a family where if you didn't slow down, then they were very vocal about it. And it was not nice.
Yeah.
And who wants to tick off grandma? Right? Like you don't want to be that person. And so so my influences were different. Mm-hmm. I have been influenced by chefs. I have been influenced by restaurants. But I can't tell you one particular instance based on walking into a restaurant where I had like this incredible aha moment. In the most positive sense. Mm-hmm. Usually when restaurants triggered me, it triggered my curiosity, hence the fact that I asked the question, why do we treat barbecue like we treat it instead of it being Southern? I love barbecue. I've done a lot of research on barbecue and was part of opening a restaurant that sells barbecue. But again, I kept saying to myself, like, isn't this Southern food? So restaurants and our craft in general tend to present questions that I need to answer for myself. And then that's really how those ideas become something tangible.
I'm curious, what are some of those books that really opened up your mind to traveling, even though you weren't physically traveling?
So as a minority, I love all things minority, and I'm not restricted by that. But women chefs are a minority, and the ones that I think are like, you know, the real trailblazers in cooking, I have sought out their books. So I own everything that Alice Waters has ever touched and or spoke to. I own Julia Child's collection. I've had the opportunity to meet them both, have and cook for them both at dinners. And that was pretty hard with Julia. I collect books. So I've got stuff from Leah Chase. I've got stuff from Dookie Chase. I mean, I've got stuff from Edna Lewis. And then just about every modern chef that you can think of, right, that we would say is relevant. And then I've got some obscure stuff, too. Currently, I'm collecting books that that are rare and collectible. Like every book that's printed, you know, I don't want to say every, but many of the books that are older African-American cookbooks want to sell you that they're the first African-American cookbook. And so since I can't figure out which one's the first one, then I just buy them all. Because they all got something.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of a hoarder in that regard. So I like collecting things. And these days, I've gravitated from tools to books.
If you hoard books, though, it's a library. You get to say that instead of you're a hoarder. It sounds classier if you say you have a library.
It only sounds classy if you're around people who will buy into that nonsense.
I'm a writer. I'm like, if you just rephrase it this way, it sounds like really, really good.
Mm-hmm. You're also in a relationship, too. And I'm just telling you, when you live with another person,
yes.
They don't buy into that BS.
So no, please. Actually, he has a creative writing degree, so he has as many books as I do, so it's great.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you guys don't live in your home, your books do.
Exactly. We are roommates with our books.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So my last question for you, if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be? Who's invited and what are you eating?
It would be in my own restaurant. And it would be my nearest and dearest that had the wherewithal to appreciate it being my last meal. And what that means is if it was going to be my last meal proper, I don't want anybody there that is going to add pressure to that moment. So if you're not right with my exit, then you should probably be at home. and it would be family style, because I love the act of handling platters and food and sharing and extending. And we wouldn't have actual servers. Everyone would partake in that service. And it would probably be many of my friends cooking, and I might jump in and cook something as well, because if it's going to be my last meal, I mean, hell, you know.
You would want to cook?
Go down in flames. Yeah, absolutely. Why take me away from the fire? and I would have people come the way that they come, you know. It wouldn't be any stipulations. I think that, you know, the experiences that I've enjoyed most in my life have been impromptu. And people have given the best of what they have. And when you start putting stipulations on things, sometimes you don't always get the best. You can push greatness out of people, but they may tell you that that's not exactly what they wanted to do, right? And I was taught very simple growing up that things that come from the heart reach the heart. And so I would want that meal to be an expression of the love or the time that we've spent together, and I don't know a way to get that by putting up boundaries.
So it'd be like potluck style, like people bring what they want.
Well, I hate that term. but remember, I said they would be cooking, So potluck, you got to bring the pot, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean you cooked it.
True.
You can pick that up on the way.
Very true.
I don't want you to go get somebody your favorite tamales and bring them to me at my last supper. I want you to cook your favorite tamales at my last supper. So.
What are you drinking?
Everything we can get our hands on. Alcohol.
You're cleaning out the bar. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And lots of it. It's my last.
Oh. Yeah. Like, what's your favorite spirit, though?
So I am a lover of all things that you can ingest. So I don't get stuck there. Remember, there were no boundaries. I don't know why you're not listening to these rules, but the rule was that there are no rules.
Yeah, right? I was about to say, okay, the there rule is there's no rules.
There you go. Right. So I'm going to drink whatever I feel like drinking.
Okay.
Period. We may start with champagne. We may end up with Negronis, and who knows? We might be in the port, right? It is the last meal.
Yeah.
Why in the world are we trying to figure out what it needs to feel like?
All right. Well, that's the first time I've gotten that answer of no rules at all.
Yeah, I tend to do things that end up like that. So,
well, Chef, thank you so much. I really appreciate chatting with you, and congratulations again on your nomination.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Cheers.
Great.
Thank God you didn't have to hit the clap button.
As the news of coronavirus reverberates throughout the world, we at HRN are especially concerned about how coronavirus will impact our food system. We will use our platform to support the restaurant, agriculture, hospitality, and other food-related industries by maintaining our coverage and operations. As social distancing becomes the temporary norm, podcasts are more important than ever. There's never been a more crucial time to stay informed about the state of our food system and the way that food connects our global community. We're sharing all of our COVID-19 coverage at heritageradionetwork.org/COVID-19. From interviews with nonprofit leaders and journalists, to firsthand accounts from chefs and restaurant owners, to reports on how the crisis is affecting regional farms. Our team is working remotely from all over to keep Food Radio alive. HRN needs your support more than ever to keep sharing essential stories and resources with our listeners. Make a donation of any amount. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
This program is powered by Simplecast.